The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen. We're reading today from the October 2020 edition of Smithsonian. When Catherine of Aragon led England's armies to victory over Scotland, in 1513, Henry VIII's first queen, acting as regent in her husband's absence, secured a major triumph at the Battle of Flodden by Milan Sully. She was, in the words of historian John Edwards, Henry VIII's greatest queen. But though Catherine of Aragon's marriage to the Tudor king lasted 24 years, collectively his five other marriages spanned just 14 years. She has long been overshadowed by her successors. The daughter of Spanish monarchs Ferdinand and Isabella, Catherine came to England as the bride of Henry's older brother, Arthur, Prince of Wales. But Arthur died shortly after the pair's wedding, leaving his 16-year-old widow in a precarious position. Though Spain and England initially sought to maintain their alliance by marrying Catherine to another member of the Tudor family, both Henry and his father, Henry VII, were suggested as potential suitors. Negotiations soured as diplomatic relations shifted. Ultimately, Catherine spent 7 years mired in uncertainty over her future. The princess's fortune shifted when Henry VII died in 1509, leaving the throne to his sole surviving son, who promptly married his alluring young sister-in-law. The couple's loving relationship, however, eventually deteriorated due to a lack of a male heir and the king's infatuation with Anne Boleyn. Catherine is often portrayed as a doughty, overly pious, stubborn old woman who refused to yield her position for the good of the kingdom. The truth, however, is more nuanced, a fact increasingly reflected in cultural depictions of the queen, including Stars, the Spanish Princess, and West End hit Six, the Musical, which features a fictionalized version of Catherine chiding her husband for forgetting that "I've never lost control, no matter how many times I knew you lied." Far from being the troublesome, unappealing wife of popular imagination, Catherine was actually a charismatic, intelligent, and much-loved queen. 3 years into the royal couple's marriage, Henry was still so besotted with his consort that he invited a Spanish visitor to look at her just to see how bella and beautiful she was. In 1513, the queen, then 27 years old, was entrusted with command of the kingdom, while her 22-year-old husband waged war against Francis I. Henry left behind a small group of advisers, but as newly discovered documents demonstrate, Catherine didn't simply defer to these elderly men's counsel. Instead, she assumed an active role in the governing and protection of England. When she is left as regent, she is in her element, says Julia Fox, author of Sister Queens, The Nobel Tragic Lives of Catherine of Aragon and Juana, Queen of Castile. She has the power to summon troops, to appoint sheriffs, to sign warrants, and to get money from the treasurer of the chamber. As Henry and his troops besieged the French town of Thérouanne, Catherine and her council readied for a clash closer to home. Just over a month into the Queen's regency, France's ally, Scotland's James IV, had declared war on England, bringing a period of peace between the neighboring nations to an end. The fact that James was married to Henry's older sister Margaret did little to dissuade either him or Catherine from entering the fray. According to 17th-century chronicler William Drummond, the pregnant Scottish queen pleaded with her husband to desist. noting that he was poised to fight a mighty people, now turned insolent by their riches at home and power abroad. But James, buoyed by possibility of conquest and of dealing a blow to his egotistical brother-in-law, refused. Catherine, for her part, appeared to relish the opportunity to exercise her full authority, says Giles Tremlett, author of Catherine of Aragon, Henry's Spanish Queen. In an August 13 letter, the Queen wrote, "My heart is very good to it." Wryly referencing women's traditional role in warfare, she added, "I am horribly busy with making standards, banners, and badges." Though Catherine did, in fact, order the royal wardrobe to furnish two banners bearing the arms of England and Spain, as well as standards of the Lion-Crowned Imperial, such tasks made up just a small portion of her preparations. Working with counselors, she mobilized forces across England, communicating with local authorities to determine how many men and horses their parishes could provide. When the mayor and sheriffs at Gloucester failed to respond in a timely fashion, she gave them a deadline of 15 days and emphasized that writing and news from the borders show that the Queen of Scots means war. In addition to recruiting soldiers, the Queen dispatched money, 10,000 pounds to be exact, artillery, gunners, a fleet of 8 ships, and supplies ranging from grain to pipes of beer and armor. She had Thomas Howard, Earl of Surrey, a combat-hardened 70-year-old veteran of the 1485 Battle of Bosworth, and his army of around 26,000 mount a first line of defense near the border with Scotland, and asked Sir Thomas Lovell to lead a secondary force in England's Midlands. What Catherine did next was unprecedented, particularly for a kingdom where warfare was considered an exclusively male domain. As records recently found at the United Kingdom's National Archives testify, this daughter of Ferdinand and Isabella, two famously bellicose rulers who'd spent Catherine's childhood driving the Muslim Moors out of the Iberian Peninsula, left the safety of London and headed north toward the English-Scottish border with 1,500 sets of armor, as well as a golden headpiece with crown that Tremlett likens to an armored sun hat in tow. The new details involve the Queen more deeply as director of events rather than a passive figurehead managed by those of Henry's counselors left in England. Sean Cunningham, the archivist who discovered the papers, told the Times, "Mark Bridges in May, they let us know that Catherine was heading for Warwick Castle and the Tower of London had pretty much been emptied of armor. Catherine and her troops were ready to face the Scots if James IV managed to defeat both Surrey's and Lovell's forces." One contemporary, Peter Martyr, reported that the Queen, in imitation of her mother Isabella, regaled her reserve army with a speech compelling them to defend their territory and remember that English courage excelled that of all other nations. This incident is widely referenced in an upcoming episode of The Spanish Princess, which will feature a highly exaggerated version of Catherine, clad in armor, fashioned to accommodate her visible pregnancy, riding directly into battle. But many historians now consider Martyr's account apocryphal. Ambassador's correspondence indicates that the Queen delivered a premature son, who died shortly after birth in October 1513, but the pregnancy's veracity remains a point of contention. In Sister Queens, Fox argues, it seems unlikely that she would have risked a much-wanted child by accompanying the armor from London. Tremlett deems the speech almost certainly invented, but points out that this doesn't mean it didn't reflect the spirit of the moment. Fox, meanwhile, says Catherine probably made a speech, but whether it was quite as rousing or as wonderful, I don't know. As it turned out, neither Lovell nor the Queen ended up seeing action. On September 9, Surrey's troops and James' army of more than 30,000 engaged in battle. The English wielded the bill, a simple hooked weapon derived from an agricultural tool, while the Scots opted for the longer steel-tipped pike. An afternoon of great slaughter, sweating, and travail ensued, and by its end some 10,000 Scots, including 12 earls, 14 lords, an archbishop, a bishop, two abbots, and James himself, lay dead. Comparatively, the smaller English army only lost around 1,500 men. The Scottish king's brutal fate was, in a way, evocative of the broader blow inflicted on his country in the wake of the defeat. As historian Leander de Lisle explains, James' left hand was almost severed, his throat gashed, and an arrow was shot through his lower jaw. Additional ignominies include one of Catherine's own hand awaited the king's corpse. With the Stuart monarch's passing, his infant son James V became the leader of a grieving, much-reduced nation. According to Fox, the Battle of Flodden, which draws its name from nearby Flodden Edge, near Scotland, in a powerless situation. She adds, "Not only have you just defeated them in a spectacular way, but the kingdom is in disarray. Scotland is practically at England's mercy." Prior to Cunningham's find, historians had only known that Catherine was in Buckingham, around 60 miles north of London, when she received word of Surrey's victory. But the new evidence suggests that the Queen intended to travel further north, if not directly into battle, like Joan of Arc, then at least into the vicinity of combat. Many a queen would have quite simply hot-footed it to the Tower of London, pulled up the drawbridge, and sat there fairly safe, says Fox. But she doesn't do that. She's no milksop. She's not taking refuge. She really is out on the road. 3 days after the battle, Catherine penned a letter to her husband, who had successfully captured Thérouanne and was now besieging Tournai. She began emphasizing Flodden's significance, writing, "To my thinking, this battle hath been to your grace and all your realm the greatest honor that could be, and more than should you win all the crown of France." As one might expect of such a deeply religious individual, the Queen proceeded to thank God for the victory and subtly remind Henry to do the same. Catherine's missive then took a rather unexpected turn. She sent her husband a piece of the Scottish King's bloodied surcoat for your banners, but lamented that she'd originally hoped to send a much more macabre trophy, the embalmed body of James himself. Unfortunately, the Queen reported, she soon realized that our Englishmen's hearts would not suffer it. This gleeful and somewhat bloodthirsty sentiment may seem out of character for a woman renowned for her piety, but as Tremlett points out, plenty of pious people were also violent, and plenty of people were violently pious. Few exemplify this seemingly contradictory mindset, as well as Catherine's own parents, who waged a relentless, violent campaign against all non-Christians in their kingdom. Ferdinand and Isabella's reconquest of Spain culminated in the January 2, 1492 fall of Granada, which marked the end of 780 years of Muslim rule in the Iberian Peninsula. Then an impressionable six-year-old Catherine watched the Moors surrender, as well as her mother's leading role in the military crusade. "This stays with her," says Fox. "This idea of a woman involved in battles is there. And when she actually comes to the divorce question, she sees it as a battle. She sees fighting for her own marriage just as important as fighting for the Catholic faith." Though Catherine was careful to praise her husband's success in France, she and other contemporary observers that Henry's triumphs paled in comparison to Flodden. As Antonia Fraser writes in The Wives of Henry VIII, the Scottish threat was removed for a generation by the slaughter of its leaders. Compared to this, the Battle of the Spurs won over the French, although part of an expensive campaign was a purely temporary check, forgotten the next year when the king turned his foreign policy on its head. Catherine wasn't the first queen to assume the reins of power in the absence of a male monarch. 60 years prior, another foreign-born princess, Margaret of Anjou, took charge of the kingdom amid the Wars of the Roses, fighting for her son's inheritance and making major decisions on behalf of her disastrously incompetent husband, Henry VI. More recently, Henry VIII's grandmother, Margaret Beaufort, an uncrowned queen, in the words of historian Nicola Tallis, had acted as regent in the brief period before the young king came of age. Years after Catherine's death, her beloved daughter, Mary I, followed in her mother's footsteps by rallying troops to her cause and seizing the throne from those who had sought to thwart her. Combined with the example set by Isabella and other relatives, says Tremlett, Catherine had some very strong role models for women who could rule, for women who could fight, whereas Margaret of Anjou's seizure of power made her deeply unpopular. Catherine's regency cemented her already sterling reputation. In the mid-1520s, when Henry first raised the question of divorcing his wife, he found that public opinion was firmly on the queen's side. She viewed the survival of her marriage as inextricable from the survival of the Catholic Church, according to Fox, and refused to back down despite immense pressure. Catherine's legacy, adds the historian, is that of a wronged woman who did not accept defeat, who fought for what she believed to be right until the breath left her body. Henry, for his part, never forgot the tenacity his wife had demonstrated. She was perfectly capable of carrying on a war as fiercely as Queen Isabella, her mother, had done for Spain. And that was by Milan Solé, Smithsonian Magazine's assistant digital editor of humanities. Up next, Things That Were Normal 100 Years Ago That Are Strange Now by Becky Robbins. Human beings are an ever-evolving species. Once we carried spears and created fantastic works of art on the walls of French caves. Today, we carry smartphones. Yes, the human species gets better and better all the time. Since the Industrial Revolution, things have changed at such a blindingly fast pace that we sometimes forget just how weird the world used to be. Because it's not all that weird anymore, right? Things that were once commonplace seem strange or even bizarre today, although it's probably also true that humans who lived 100 years ago would think the things we do are pretty strange and bizarre also. Sadly, we don't have any way to actually show an early 20th century person a YouTube video of someone eating a Tide Pod, but we can at least enjoy our own bemusement at the strange and bizarre habits of our recent ancestors, mostly because it's okay to make fun of people who have been dead for decades. This sounds like the plot of but sadly, it's actually a pre-apocalyptic nonfiction. 100 years ago, in many big cities in the United States, it was illegal to be ugly. Let's take Chicago as an example. According to the Chicago Tribune, in 1881, Alderman James Peavy decided he'd had enough of the eye-assaulting horrors of other people's misfortune. So he introduced an ordinance to ban people who were diseased, maimed, mutilated, or in any way deformed, so as to be an unsightly or disgusting object. From the streets of Chicago, where they might make people uncomfortable, if you were deemed too ugly to be in public, you had to pay a fine of $1 to $50, which was a decent sum then, or go to the poorhouse, which was kind of like an insane asylum for poor people. After World War I, when veterans returned home from missing limbs and other disfiguring battle scars, public opinion toward the disabled started to change, but ugly laws remained on the books, and their enforcement continued up until the 1950s. Chicago's ugly law wasn't officially dropped until 1974. Now, we'd love to say we're way more enlightened today, but fat shaming is still a thing, so collective enlightenment is perhaps still forthcoming. But at least fat shaming isn't written into law. What would literature be without the lowly orphan, consigned to a sad life of scrubbing floors with toothbrushes and sharing a bedroom with 25 similarly unfortunate children, only to be occasionally saved by kindly millionaires and giants who are bad at pronouncing things? Orphanages are ubiquitous in children's stories, but they aren't really a thing anymore, at least not in the little orphan Annie sense of the word. The first American orphanage was established in 1729 after a massacre took out most of the adults in a Mississippi settlement. Before that, kids who lost their parents went to live with relatives, were apprenticed to tradesmen, or ended up begging on city streets. According to Virginia Commonwealth University, the American practice of stuffing kids into orphanages, even though many of them weren't even orphans but the children of poor single mothers, didn't really start to come into question until the 1920s, when most states implemented mothers' pensions. That gave poor mothers the financial ability to care for their own children rather than placing them in institutionalized care. Orphanages started to phase out in the early 20th century, although they do still exist in another form. Orphans today are sometimes put in group homes when there aren't enough foster families to take care of them. You won't find kids dressed in rags with shaved heads scrubbing floors with toothbrushes in any of these modern facilities, though, and probably not too many kindly millionaires either. Before there was Halloween, this is titled Trick or Turkey. Before there was Halloween, there was Thanksgiving. No, really. People used to dress up in costumes, run around the city streets making noise, and go to costume parties on Thanksgiving. According to NPR, the tradition was so well loved that in 1897, the LA Times reported that Thanksgiving was the busiest time of the year for manufacturers of and dealers in masks and false faces. If that isn't enough to make your head spin, costume kids would also march in troops around their neighborhoods and ask adults anything for Thanksgiving, and the adults would give them candy. Okay, so that's how it started. The custom bothered a lot of people. In fact, New York's school superintendent, who was almost certainly related to the guy who came up with the whole ugly law thing, complained that the tradition seemed designed to mostly just annoy adults and was incompatible with modernity. Anyway, it might surprise you to hear that this particular Thanksgiving tradition is sort of still around, and now you mostly only see elaborate Thanksgiving costumes in Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. Kids really didn't want to give up the whole candy-getting thing, though. And by the 1930s, the practice of going door-to-door in search of treats became a holiday tradition, although it was mostly an organized event meant to curtail Halloween vandalism and violence, hence the expression, trick-or-treat. When cigarettes cured asthma. As it turns out, Dr. Oz wasn't actually the first bona fide doctor to give terrible medical advice. 100 years ago, it was not only common for doctors to dismiss the risks of smoking, but sometimes they would also appear in tobacco advertising, saying things like cigarettes provide temporary relief from paroxysms and asthma. Now, these ads are often featured very doctorly-looking faces and declared such nonsense as 20,679 physicians agree that cigarettes are awesome, and an eminent scientist writes that cigarettes are no worse for you than a glass of water. However, the doctors and eminent scientists would usually remain conspicuously unnamed. The reason cigarette companies did this is pretty insidious. By the early 20th century, most people were kind of catching on to the whole cigarettes might be bad for you thing, which is what consumers will naturally do when they notice that a product seems to be associated with people dying. What's even sadder, of course, is that those doctors endorse cigarette ads persisted well into the 60s, when the Surgeon General finally said, "Hey, guess what? You've all been right all along. Smoking is bad for you." Dresses for everyone. Right or wrong, we live in a world where baby girls wear pink and baby boys wear blue, because the consequences of being called a boy when you're really a girl, when you're really a boy, just too horrible to comprehend, or something. 100 years ago, that seems to have mattered a lot less, which is kind of surprising given how uptight people were in the early 20th century. It was common and maybe even fashionable for boys to wear dresses, sometimes up to around age 8. According to the Vintage News, no one thought it was weird, and it served a practical purpose. When you're potty training, it's just easier if you're always wearing a dress. Back in the Renaissance, this actually made a lot of sense because the fastenings on men's breeches and trousers were ridiculously complicated, way too complicated for most kids to figure out. By the late 20th century, people mostly just put boys in dresses because that's what you did. After World War I, the practice seems to have mostly died out, but people still put baby boys in dresses for a few decades after that, though you'll rarely see any photographic evidence, perhaps because men who wore dresses as babies put those pictures in the fire when no one was looking. And lastly, Venice's controversial inflatable floodgates saved the city for a second time. The barriers may not be a permanent solution, but they've now protected Venice from two floods this month by Rasha Aridi. On October 3, Venice's new barrier system protected the city for the first time from high tides and severe flooding by blocking the water from surging into the lagoon and over the island. But last Thursday, the barriers once again shielded Venice from a 4.6-foot tide that could have flooded half the city, The Guardian. And that's going to wrap things up for today's reading of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Frank Urban for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen. We thank them for their support. This program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138.